The Skiffy and Fanny Show is listener-supported, which means basically you guys listen and we feel really good about ourselves. But if you'd also like to help us a little bit, you can go to audibletrial.com/skiffyandfanty, sign up for a 1-month free trial membership, get a free book, which is pretty cool, and the bonus is that it helps us a little bit. So go ahead and check that out at audibletrial.com/skiffyandfanty and enjoy the episode.
It's one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind.
But the Krell forgot one thing, yes. Monsters, John. Monsters from the id.
There you go again, always blaming me for everything.
Go switch off!
It's a trap!
This looks extraordinarily bad.
Commencing countdown. T minus 5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
Welcome to the Skiffy and Fanny Show, episode 177. I'm Sean.
And I'm Stina.
And our guest today is Nick Mamatas. Welcome to the show again, Nick.
Well, thanks for having me again.
So this time, as I said, it would be a proper interview, which means we're going to be asking you lots of really hard questions about the book, such as, you know, things like why did you write that word on page 150? Except there, although there are 150 pages. Yes, there are.
Sure,
so we're
there
good.
Are. Yeah, there are. Yeah.
Sorry, I'm going by like PDF page numbers, and that was not. But in any case, I want to start with the first question, which is mostly just to kind of get you to talk a little bit about this book. So. What is this book? How would you describe this book to somebody who's perhaps never read any of your work before?
I would say that Love is the Law is a noir novel that is essentially a tribute on one level to the book The Long Secret, which was the sequel to Harriet the Spy. And another level is about Trotskyism and Aleister Crowley.
I just love the way you put those two things together. So it brings me to one of the things that's really curious about this book is that it has these three sort of social political paradigms. So you have on the one hand the sort of punk elements, your main character, I think probably fair to describe her as a punk figure. Then you have the Aleister Crowley and the kind of the magic and the occult being played with. And then on top of that, you have the sort of Trotskyism and communism, both kind of get played around with, and these things that are the I think the primary focuses in terms of the political aspects. And I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about what compelled you to put these three components together into one novel.
Well, partially just because I think people of the age of the character, Dawn, who is in her late teens, early 20s, are attracted to this sort of thing, especially in the late 80s. There's a contradiction between the three, but of course everyone's beliefs are contradictory. Nobody has consistent beliefs. They might seem more contradictory when you bring up, you know, Aleister Crowley and Leon Trotsky together, only because few people believe in either of those, and almost nobody believes in both of them. So there's not been a lot of social practice in pasting over or papering over the internal contradictions of believing in both at once. And a lot of the book is her trying to believe in both at once, trying to turn Crowley into a communist, which is a sort of a fool's errand, and trying to use communist dialectics as a way to achieve occult wisdom.
So this actually, and I have to apologize, but I know very little about Aleister Crowley other than his basic existence. What is it about these sort of Trotskyism and communism, et cetera, and Crowley's sort of, I guess you might call it a philosophy, that is so contradictory?
Well, Crowley was an individualist and an idealist, and Trotsky, as a Marxist, was a collectivist and a materialist. So I'd say they are diametrically opposed.
Fair enough.
However, because of that, they attract the same sort of person.
And why do you think that is, that the contradiction is drawing in the same type of person?
Well, I think that most people have a sort of a combination of idealism and materialism in their lives, and most people have some individualistic and some collectivist impulses in their lives. Of course, most of us are individuals on some level, but we have families and social groups that we tie ourselves to or emerge out of, you know, depending on your point of view. And the same with anything else. People believe in the material reality around them, but they also believe in their thoughts and abstractions like democracy or God. And they try to, you know, cultivate a life, you know, a life or a worldview out of these disparate things. But to go to some extreme, you have to be dissatisfied with what other people are thinking, with what's going on around you. So both Crowley and Trotsky seem to attract people who are dissatisfied and who also have a vision of themselves as somehow historically important. You know, Crowley talked about a new eon that was emerging. Trotsky, of course, was a revolutionary and believed that there would be a worldwide communist revolution. And they both believe in this sort of worldwide revolution that requires the practice of individuals or groups or classes to bring it about.
Sina, go ahead and jump in. I think you got one for him there.
Yeah, I was just going to ask about why Crowley, because there's a very extreme range of belief systems that fit within the whole occult spectrum, and I thought it was interesting that you chose Crowley. But when I think about it now, and you're talking about the level, the ego, I suppose, the ego of the character, and then the ego of Trotsky, and then the ego of it all kind of fits. So I guess maybe I'm answering my own question. But
okay. I wanted her to be tough. I wanted the lead character, Dawn, to be tough. And, you know, certainly I could have made her an anarchist pagan, which goes together a little bit more smoothly. And, you know, you've met plenty of 19-year-old punk rockers who believe themselves to be pagan, powerful priestesses and hardcore anarchists. And then by the age 25, they're, you know, just doing yoga and voting for the Democrats like everybody else. So I wanted her to be tough. So I chose Trotsky and Crowley.
It's very interesting. And one of the things that it seemed to me that, and maybe now it that connection I'm making is now falling apart, but that these three things are very much tied together, not just simply because they're in the novel, but one of the interesting things you'd already said is that you were putting these together in at least in part because they hadn't been necessarily put together much already. That somebody who's a Crowleyite or a follower of Crowley and also a Trotskyite as together. But it was really interesting how even, and we haven't talked about the punk stuff yet, which I suspect Stina will be very interested in because she has, in her own work, has written a little bit, at least within the Irish context, about punk. But how would you see that the punk world, or and particularly this, you present a lot of the sort of musical side of that world, fit into this sort of trifecta paradigm of social things?
Well, that's the same thing, right? Punk is the music, at least in the late 80s, certainly, that was very difficult to get your hands on. Certainly on Long Island in the 80s, it was dominated by popular music, primarily sort of a dance or club music, with a underground of metal. And of course, there's a huge number of connections between metal and the occult. Yeah. But there was, in real life, in the 80s, you know, a thin punk strain for people who were, for whom even metal could not satisfy. Because at the time, metal was very ascendant. You know, there was Headbangers Ball, you could go to Nassau Coliseum and see your favorite band. It's, you know, it was just accessible. A lot of metal is can be retrograde or reactionary. Not all of it, obviously, but so somebody like Don would be attracted to punk. Also, punk is, again, a movement in a way that metal isn't. Right? Punk is about DIY, and on some level, some of them changing society or creating a society within society. So, again, it matches more closely to both Crowley and Trotskyism than other kinds of popular music that would. And everyone had some sort of allegiance, some kind of music at that age.
Yeah, the politics of punk, I think, tended more towards anarchy.
Sure.
But I think it works because I knew plenty of people who perceived punk as just anything you threw together and ta-da! And, you know, largely it was.
of people also saw punk as a way to recruit. You know, Hare Krishnas were recruiting inside punk. Maoists were recruiting inside punk. So it certainly wasn't unusual for there to be some Trotsky-ist type of element in Cy-Punk, too. In the UK, there's a few pretty famous skin bands, like Redskins, for example. So it's not unusual that there would be some person. But of course, you know, also, for the most part, Dawn is a loner. You know, she's sort of adrift on Long Island. So her allegiance to the punk community is pretty much on some level a pose, on another level a wish.
I just got to pause because you said the Hare Krishnas were using punk as a recruiting tool.
Sure, yeah, this is really well known.
Well, it's not for me. I'm so like flabbergasted by it. We have Hare Krishnas on my campus, and they just serve food and they play their little drums and they sing Hare Krishna. I was not aware. I'm sorry, say that again.
1989. If you were a street kid on Lower East Side of 1988, 1989, and you wanted a few vegetarian meals, you'd go to the Hare Krishnas and they'd sort of, you know, do their little love bombing on you and whatnot. And a few of them became fairly prominent punks. People were part of the club mags, were, you know, part of Christian consciousness. Yeah, it's happened. They didn't dominate the punk scene, but there certainly was an influence on the punk scene.
I'm never going to look at the Hare Krishnas the same again.
Yeah.
Well, actually, he's right. There's a farm that's not far from Austin. There's like a whole cult that actually preyed on the, they did actually try to recruit a lot of the street kids around the area, particularly during that time. And I can't remember the name of the farm, and I was just about to look it up before I opened my face, but I didn't. But anyway, I'm not going to bother, because why give them more?
Well, let's go to the character of Dawn really quick. And Steen, if you want to jump back on any of the punk questions later, that we could definitely backtrack. But I'm really interested in this character of Dawn, and I think one of the things that I find so fascinating about her is I disagree with her on so many things, but yet as I'm reading this character, I kind of keep wanting to find out more about how she views the world, because it seemed to me that, at least the way I was reading it, that her perspective of the world is at least within her character rationalized within her own sort of worldview, and that was something that becomes more and more complicated as the book goes along. And I'm curious, you know, how did you go about creating this character, and particular in sort of presenting her consciousness, her perspective or worldview? I mean, developing that I imagine probably there's a part of this that kind of went along as you were writing the book. But I'm curious about that creative process and in developing her as a person.
It's me. She's me.
She's you? Really?
Yeah.
Now okay, so why?
Why am I me?
No, well, I mean, that's a big question. I don't know if you could answer that. That changes the question. Now it's you know, if it's coming from an autobiographical perspective, are you like Josh and me? Like, it really is you?
Well, yeah, it's me, but it also everybody else in there is me too.
I'm so confused.
See, now tell him. Tell him how writing works.
It is exactly how writing works. Actually, yes, he's absolutely right. I have to tell you, I'm sorry. I don't mean to burst your bubble there.
I get that, but the way he said it implies that he is inside of himself many people at once.
And so are you, Sean. So is Stina. So is everyone you've met. Certainly, everyone contains multitudes, right?
And what he's right.
The writer's task is to sort of explore those multitudes. That's what makes a character interesting or complex, if they have more than one trait. And certainly, you've never met anybody with only one trait, right? But how do you express that dramatically is the question of interest.
That's true. Okay. You totally deflated my question.
Yeah.
Like, wow. Man. Like, I was not expecting an author to be like, yeah, that character's me. You know, because usually, at least in my experience, authors are not very willing to say that person is a part of me.
No, that's part of why I retired from science fiction, because of all these affectations and all this tentativeness about writing characters and going deep in that kind of thing, honestly.
Okay, so explain that point a little bit more.
The science fiction as a field, as opposed to a genre that is a field of production where you can go to conventions, you go to Clarion, you learn certain aphorisms about writing, you practice to a certain extent and write for certain markets, leads to, I think, a kind of almost shame about being a writer while you're writing. In that, so many stories are about other stories. The idea of putting something personal in to a story is, even though it's very common, it's inescapable, has to be kind of obscured or occulted. And we see this a lot with sort of the racial and gender politics, for example. People say, why would you have a woman? Why do you make that person gay in your story? And all that kind of thing. Because this idea, this default, is this sort of a blank, white, bourgeois male subject who then meets an alien or finds a machine or does what? Whatever, you know, because the character is elated or erased on some level.
So in some sense, you would perhaps say that as a field, SF&F, it prevents, by the way it structures itself and creates its writers to some extent, it prevents writers from approaching certain kinds of characters and perspectives precisely because it says that those are somehow inappropriate because it doesn't fit the default position, whatever that position may be.
That's one way that manifests. Another way it manifests is just this idea that, I'm a writer, I'm just a craftsman, maybe doing a working man-like job of putting sentences together and making a great idea, and characters are for those literary homosexuals, and sex is for those romance women, and fisticuffs and bad words, those are for those mystery tough guys, me. That's what I mean.
That's interesting. Okay. And Steve, you had your hand up, so why don't you jump in really quick?
Yeah, I wanted to disagree because these are the things that I'm fighting. This is why I'm here. This is why I'm staying, and I'm bloody well not gonna go.
Well, then you do agree. You just want to change it. I decided to leave.
No, yeah. You just disagree on the end result, not necessarily on the
You agree with the issue with the description of the field.
Yes, I do. Yeah. I do agree with that description of the field.
No, having said that, I'm sorry. Go ahead, Steena. I'm sorry.
I do believe that there are some people who are in the field who try to mystify the role of the writer and try to pretend like everything is – they hear voices and like all this kind of – and that's kind of bullshit because you're working with your subconscious, really. Yeah. I mean, ultimately, you're working with your subconscious. Yeah. And I've said this on more panels and, you know, because that's what you're doing. You're daydreaming. You're working with your subconscious. Certain things come out. Characters are all part of you, who you are. They are also part bits and pieces of the people that you perceive in your life. As you perceive them, not as they perceive themselves. So there's all of that going on. And then there are other people who are behaving just as you say. So, yeah, I guess I don't fit in because I take the psychological aspect of it. And therefore, the more, dare I say it, literary end of it. But there you are.
So what's your next question, Sean?
You're gutting all of my questions, man. You can't do this. I'm just so fascinated by this.
It's what he lives for.
I'm really fascinated by this perspective because on a level I absolutely agree with you. And I just feel really strange asking questions that I should just be asking, going directly and be like, you know, what part of this is you, your personal perspective showing up in the work? Because there is a like reticence or refusal or uncomfortableness with talking about how the personal gets into the fiction.
Yeah. Well, there are two problems with the question, right? One is what you're describing is this reticence or this timidity, which is common, especially inside science fiction, I think. Second is I don't know. I wrote the book to find out, and I still don't know.
Fair enough.
You know, I was reading the other day, someone says that artists and writers communicate indirectly with people, which means they communicate primarily through the work. And then when you ask them about the work, they're I don't know. What? I wrote a story about that, bleh, that kind of thing. And actually, Olivia and I were at Seattle back in June, I guess, for the Locus Awards, and Olivia turned to me afterward after meeting a lot of writers and my writer little pals and acquaintances and said, oh, they seem nice. Pretty boring, though. And, of course, they're boring. Why are these people boring? I find them exciting. I find them exciting and interesting because I've read their stories. She hasn't read their stories, so what's left are these sort of just dopey husks with their puns and their complaints about royalty checks.
Right, which from her perspective, perhaps those aren't things that are interesting.
Yeah, the horse racing stuff isn't interesting.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, those are things that are, I think.
But if you read somebody's story, then met them, you can say, oh, now I get it, on a way that you wouldn't get it previously, even if you were entertained by the story by itself, or if you were well acquainted with this individual without having read her story, or without having read his story.
Because in a way, the fiction is a gateway to the things that person's interested in.
That's right. Yeah.
And I guess the secondary question to the kind of the reasons behind why you're leaving genre, but also the surrounding
questions. Well, this genre. You know,
at least this genre.
That's another sort of science fiction universalism. I see this all the time. I mentioned I was on a panel last year talking about writing and translation, and my day job, which I've not retired from, is science fiction and translation. And I mentioned that, well, there's a big translated hit a few years ago, The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo, and the woman next to me said, but that's not genre! I said, of course it is.
Yeah,
it's the mystery genre. It's just not this genre.
But yeah,
there is this weird. This is a strange impulse. This strange rhetoric of science fiction, where we are a genre, not just a genre. Still not even the genre, but we are genre, and everything else out there is some unknown land, some terra incognita.
Oh my God!
Full of no dragons, because we have all the dragons.
What the hell?
But it's absolutely you're absolutely right, because when you look at it, like. All of these groupings, that the mostly marketing categories, are genres. They're romance is a genre.
Yeah, yeah,
yeah.
I always talk about them as genres, though.
I know, but you saw your pal Sean just here just a second ago said leaving genre.
I made the mistake verbally of saying that. That's not what I meant.
I understand what you meant. I understand that.
Yeah.
No, my point is that mistake that you made, I don't think was just a slip of the tongue so much as I'm not trying to criticize you either. I'm just saying that is a very common slip of the tongue, and it's so common slip of the tongue inside this genre, the science fiction genre, that I think it's become a rhetorical strategy inside the genre.
Ah. It's
a million times, so you just said it.
Yeah, oh, absolutely.
Without
guessing, yeah.
You know, that kind of thing.
There's all kinds of things that we learn and that we say all the time. It just so happens that in this particular genre, I will be careful.
There you go. There you go. Yeah.
This particular genre, it is kind of it is weird. The kind of exclusiveness of science fiction and fantasy at times.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And I find that even with I'll be totally honest, it'd be very uncommon at least to see work like this particular one, Love is the Law. The kinds of it's got weird aspects to it, the occult. It's got these sort of private eye, sort of crime fiction elements to it. It's got all these kinds of punk things, but also even the way in which the character speaks, her sexual politics, her personal aphorisms, those kinds of things. That would be something that would be very uncommon to find within science fiction and fantasy.
Absolutely.
Generally, and I sometimes I find that really sad.
And one reason why I started writing crime fiction was that I can write other kinds of characters.
Yeah. And it does seem, because in this particular case with Love is the Law, this character is, I mean, it's not like anybody I've read, and mostly because I've been reading, science fiction fantasy, so that's probably part of it, and Caribbean literature, but not like anybody I'd read before, which now that I understand it's now you, now I understand so much about you, Nick. So kind of just jumping away from all of that then, and going back maybe a little bit to more of the kind of political aspects here. Stina just left a note that we could head into crime fiction. Actually, that would be a great one, and we can save the political question for later. But I guess the question I would start with crime fiction is actually what is it about crime fiction beyond the kinds of what you've already said about that you would be able to write kinds of characters that would be very difficult to write in, say, science fiction or fantasy. What about crime fiction for you is of interest? What draws you to it?
Oh, a few things. I mean, both as a reader and a writer. As a reader, it's really interesting because if you read a lot of science fiction or a lot of one genre, anything else that you start reading is a nice break. Like, oh, this is pretty exciting. This is not the usual kind of thing. Like my friend Tim Pratt, he basically reads crime fiction all the time. because he works for Locus. He writes, you know, 3 or 4 novels a year for Dungeons and Dragons and his own work and that kind of thing. And he is steeped in the field up to his eyebrows. So when he needs a break from science fiction, he reads a ton of crime fiction. And I started reading a ton of crime fiction a couple of years ago, and I found it really exciting and interesting, especially noir, which is my favorite subgenre or genre of crime. And so I started experimenting with writing it, and it was very interesting and challenging because the usual tricks you can do in fantasy or science fiction, just like in this, you know, appeal to the sublime or appeal to some trope that everybody knows how it already works. So you don't have to explain it too much to solve the problem of a story in its writing, both as a plot, was no longer available. So it was a special challenge to write a crime story because it's harder to win suspension of disbelief.
Yeah,
so just as a challenge, it was interesting. And I got really involved in it and reading it really deeply. And I love short stories in crime. There are tons of short stories in crime, not so many as in science fiction, but it's also even more of a challenge to create something that sort of clicks together as a perfect puzzle box or as a little bit or as a perfect sculpture. So I just really got into it. And I also noticed, just as part of the field, if I go to a crime section or a mystery section of a bookstore, I can find the best writers in the genre right there. Ken Bruin, he's the best. 4 or 5 books right there on the shelf. Pelicanos, he's there. 70 books on the shelf. Classics, you know, like Dorothy Sayers can find 9, 10 books on the shelf. If I go to a science fiction section, can I find the best writers in the field on the shelf? Maybe a couple stories in an anthology. Maybe a couple China Miéville books. Maybe a Cat Valente book. But a lot of the science fiction stuff that I find on the shelves aren't really what I consider the best writers. I gotta go hunting for the best writers.
Yeah. I have to say, Nick, that when I... when you mentioned that you were heading towards it, to crime fiction, it makes sense to me for you. I read a lot of crime fiction myself, so I really like it. And yeah. And your voice, just reading this book, it very much fits in that genre very well. So I think it probably is a good move for you. I mean, I don't want you to go away.
Well, he's with Heiko Suro, so he's not going to be totally disappeared.
That's right. No. My day job will bring me to conventions and whatnot.
Do you find that, not just in terms of the kinds of perspectives that you're able to play with crime fiction, do you find that the things like cross-genre or that in some way crime fiction is opening you up to something that you otherwise would never have been able to do?
I don't know why I go that far.
Okay.
I mean, I'm able to do anything, right? But it's as far as fun. One of the issues is, if I'm able to do it, can I get someone to pay me for it or to publish it or to show it to readers? So that can be a challenge. And crime fiction does allow things that SF doesn't allow. And of course, SF allows things that crime fiction doesn't allow.
That's true, yeah. Interesting. So, and this makes me wonder, and I know I mentioned it's a Worldcon, and now I remember the title of a book, and it was the book I was thinking of. Where in talking about this book too, a book called Last Days by Brian Evanson.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if you've read it.
I have read it, yes.
Okay. I love that book.
It's a great book.
Yeah, and it's another one of those kinds of, you know, he I think, at least within the genre, the science fiction fantasy community, is perhaps better known for writing maybe sort of horror. And that particular book is more of a, I would describe it as noir, but I don't know if you would yourself.
Well, Evanston's an interesting figure. He's actually really well known as a writer of literary fiction, specifically transgressive fiction. He is the head of the MFA program, or was the head of the MFA program, maybe things have changed, at Brown University, which is one of the most prestigious MFA programs in the country. Last Days itself, if I remember correctly, began as a chapbook called The Brotherhood of Mutilation. That was the first half of the book, put up by Earthling Press. So it was like a limited edition chapbook by a specialty horror publisher. But of course, with the part of the second novel that comes in makes it a noir, but also this very strange, absurdist noir that really lies into a transgressive literary fiction, and that's really interesting. And I think Brian Evanson is great. He's one of my favorite writers, and sure, on some levels, he's a big contemporary influence, absolutely.
Oh, interesting. Oh, yeah. So you actually consider him an influence on your work?
Sure.
Oh, wow. Okay.
And vice versa, actually. My little, a few years ago, when we first started communicating, he sent me a fan letter. And he's like, oh. I had sent him a fan letter because I read a story of his in an anthology called Paris Spheres. And he wrote back saying, oh, Nick, I've heard of you. I read your first novella, Northern Gothic, and I used it. I used one of your techniques in my forthcoming book. I was like, oh, my God, you used one of my techniques in your forthcoming book, and you're Brian Levinson. Oh! So that was pretty exciting.
So you really did have one. Of...
Okay. Yeah.
That's great. Cause,
that's awesome.
That's pretty cool to receive that kind of praise from somebody you yourself admire.
Yeah, absolutely.
Cool. So, the crime fiction in some ways is – you're turning to it in some sense because you're wanting to explore a different experience, and also because of the kinds of maybe closed-mindedness that is sometimes found, or perhaps maybe in your perspective is too frequently found within science fiction and fantasy.
Yes.
Since you've been reading so much of this sort of noir crime fiction, who would you say are some other than someone like Brian Evanson are some of your influences?
Goodis, David Goodis, who is everybody's influence. So that's like saying, who is your influence? Heinlein, need that. Yeah. But David Goodis is a huge influence. Pelicanos, who I mentioned previously. Goodens, Ken Bruin, who I mentioned previously. Sarah Gran, who writes all sorts of things. I think we talked about her a little bit at Worldcon. And her recent series is of interest to anyone who also enjoys fantasy, because it has a fantastical book as a sort of the core of the series, the Claire DeWitt series. That's Sarah Gran with no H, S-A-R-A-G-R-A-N. So folks like that, Megan Abbott, another great contemporary crime/noir writer. And of course, Benjamin Black, who is a pseudonym for a famous literary writer. I think he does great crime fiction. I like his crime fiction better than his literary fiction, actually, even though he thinks his literary fiction is awesome and he does crime as sort of a lark. So a lot of folks like that. But interestingly, I always, when I was a kid, I didn't like mysteries because I'd read science fiction and get all these great ideas, and then it would devolve into a mystery plot. I'd think, oh, you have these great ideas and this great planet and spaceships, and you, oh, it's a mystery. So I never liked that. And even today, I don't really like police procedurals or PI sleuthing that much. I like crime as a social trespass, and then characters deal with it. Or commit more.
So for you, what is it that you don't like so much about the more procedural side of crime fiction? When you're a kid, maybe you didn't like it because it was boring because you were reading science fiction for the gosh bang wow. Yeah. But since you say today, you still don't find that very fascinating. So what doesn't draw you to the police procedural?
I guess a conversation with China Mievel I had sort of eliminated for me a couple of years ago. He was saying why he doesn't like it. This is when The City and the City came out, and when he wrote his noir, as he called it, noir/weird novel. I think we should call it Weird Boiled instead. But what he said is that he loved mysteries until the end. He loved it when everything was mysterious and unknown and peculiar and strange and occulted. And then it turns out, oh, but that guy did it. And it's almost always some sort of disappointment. It's sort of like going to a magic show and looking at the magic trick, and someone says, and here's how I did it.
Because it takes the magic away.
Yeah. So noir doesn't quite do that because it's not about the aspect of solving a crime, but just about the social reverberations of a crime.
Oh, that's interesting. So
that
the police
makes sense.
Procedural.
I like it.
Oh, I'm sorry. Go ahead, Sina.
No, that makes sense. I really like it. But I have to sneak this in because I always ask everybody, have you read Adrian McKinty?
No.
You really should.
Okay. How do you spell that?
A-D-R-I-A-N, okay. Adrian McKinty, McKinty.
All right, great.
Also Gerard Brennan.
Huh, that sounds like a rings a bell. I might have a book of his around here somewhere.
Yeah, Gerard Brennan.
I don't know
Brennan
if I've read it yet, but I, like anyone else who's a writer, I have a lot of books I've not read or can even keep track of. So there might be one of his around here. That rings a bell.
Perfect. Okay, so just a really quick then to just jump us back to the book proper, since now all of my questions about characters are no longer relevant because they're all Nick.
Yeah.
they're all you. And now when, you know, 100 years from now, we'll be using this to profile you.
Mm-hmm.
But okay, so another thing that I was really interested with is the way the book is structured, and primarily with the way the narrative, the perspective of the character is structured, because it is stream of consciousness is not how I would describe it, but I couldn't figure out another word to describe it because it's very much in the character's head. And I was really curious about when sort of major events happen, they happen very quickly and sometimes, at least for me, were confusing, but in a way that was more, it was fascinating because it was something happened and a whole bunch of weird shit happened. And then I had to pause because I didn't fully understand. I don't think the character fully understands at these moments either. And there's almost this surreal quality to some of the different events that occur in the plot.
Can you give us an example?
Okay, so the moment when they go see the abyssal
eyeballs.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and they're in this cellar, and just the moment they walk up to the door, and the guy comes out, and he's like, "You gotta go out the back," and he throws the sign on the door, and then he shuts the door in their face, and they go down, and it felt almost like a literary acid trip. It was very strange, and I think obviously.
Well, once again, I guess I gotta say that's just how these shows go.
You ever is it
do
really how they go?
Did you ever do a basement punk show?
I've never
seen it.
So that's how punk shows go. Is that what you just said?
Like a house show. You ever go to a house show in a basement? In someone's
Actually,
basement.
No.
They were pretty popular in Long Island, different parts of the country, where yeah, there would be no. You just go to a house show.
Yeah, they don't have those in Texas, to my knowledge.
Yeah. So you often end up next to put up next to somebody's furnace, watching this show. And the idea that there's no stage is very important to some aspects of punk, because that would elevate the performer in a way that he need not be elevated. So there's a lot of weird mixture. And so it's just a surreal experience.
Which seems surreal to me because I've never had it.
That's right.
Yeah. But for you,
get out, Sean.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
You should get out more, Sean.
I should get out more. Because in Gainesville, Florida, they have so many of these shows.
You know, that's where a lot of this sort of thing comes from, places that are relatively repressed. Actually, that's why it's a... Punk is interesting because there's a DIY culture, so anybody can just make it themselves out of nothing.
Yes.
So look around. You never know.
There might be a basis.
That's one of the connections between punk and the occult that I have in the book, this idea that there's another secret world most people don't know about.
Yeah, I came from punk. I came to punk via goth. So
right.
From the goth end of things, there was a lot of the whole occult thing was an aspect of things, largely from that side of it. But that's why I'm not really as familiar with the punk side of things in Austin specifically, because I didn't hang out with those kids. I hung out with the goths.
And Austin has so many music venues that there may not even been necessary to have a basement show network or a house party show network.
Yeah, because we don't have basements anyway. But,
exactly.
Yeah.
Well, they don't have them in Florida. You can't put it below the ground. You can't do that. It's too humid.
I thought it was really interesting that I really like the way that you've played with the character, in that cutting behaviors tend to be about control issues and needing to control. And at the same time, she's punk and she's into the whole, as I said before, punk I've always associated with anarchy and throwing everything out there. So it's like she's constantly push-pulling on, she wants to be absolutely in control. She can't think this way because if she does, she punishes herself. And then at the same time, she's doing these completely chaotic things and everything is, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
I thought that was really cool.
And that's, I think, the triple question again. You know, in punk, there's a lot of discussion of anarchism and anarchy and freedom, but also a lot of discussion of discipline.
Yep.
So people like straight edge people are very disciplined, or they consider themselves very disciplined. They don't eat meat, or they don't drink, and they don't look at girls or look at boys or whatever as much as other people do. And certainly, punk has a fascistic element to it, too. Many of the, even if they're not outright fascist bands, there's a lot of military and pseudo-military iconography and the logos.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah. So there is that push-pull, because there's people trying to find a rite of passage into adulthood, and it's difficult to find when you're making it yourself. And the same is true in the occult, that you want to master the world around you and you want to master yourself so that you can do what? Well, whatever you like.
Yeah.
And the same thing is true of even communism, with this idea of the revolution, which is a very chaotic moment or chaotic period, emerges from which a new order will emerge. So how do you cultivate this sort of new order is a question. Do you sell newspapers on Saturday mornings every Saturday for 45 years? Do you join the Occupy movement? Do you go off into the woods with a gun? You know, do you send bombs to politicians and airlines? You know, that's a huge tactical and strategic question.
And in your particular book, one of the characters, one of the side characters actually believes that the revolution is going to happen by all these disparate groups suddenly rising up at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, which is a different kind of almost like a flash mob revolution, but mm-hmm. one in which the actors don't realize they're part of the same thing.
Right. And that happens. I mean, that happens all the time. If you look at the Arab Spring, that's something that happened. Why there's so much confusion about the Arab Spring and the fallout. Because all these, the Al-Qaeda taking over, is it the people taking over? Well, it's all these things. If you look at Syria, the rebellion against Assad is, a lot of them are Al-Qaedas, and a lot of them are secular people who are leftists, and a lot of them are people who just want Assad gone, you know, but want to replace it with their own kind of Assad-ism.
Or something like Assad. Egypt. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Or even something
with
like
Egypt. When the Muslim Brotherhood won, the people think, oh, they ruined it, it's gone forever. Then, of course, the Muslim Brotherhood went out. And now the military's back. But is the military really back? Are they back the way they were with the previous regime? No. So things are ongoing. Revolutions are processes, not events. And there's always a bunch of people involved, a bunch of disparate things. And even at a little protest, if you ever go to a protest or demonstration, you'll find, regardless of how narrow the topic of the protest is, you'll find tons of people there doing other things. You'll find tons of people there doing, you know, competing chants. So if you were, you know, protesting the Vietnam War, for example, you might say, bringing them home now. Other people might say, victory of the NLF. Other people might say, this is unconstitutional war, because they're sort of right-wing libertarian anti-war people. And there's a fight. There's a fight inside the protest, inside the movement, for who's going to win. And that's the kind of thing that happens all the time, you know, in all sorts of politics.
Yeah, I mean, that's how I look at history, actually. When it's happening, there's so much chaos. History with a capital H doesn't happen until people have filtered out a majority of what was
until
reported.
Until historians write it, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
And even so with the processes of change, like, I mean, you think of any moment of change, even something mundane like maybe mundane is the wrong way to describe it, but something like gay rights right now, where it's mm-hmm. all kinds of people asking for. I mean, there's one big message: everyone wants gay rights, but what those rights mean do actually change within the various groups.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, everyone's kind of arguing their own positions, and slowly but surely something's getting filtered out, and we're having something actually happen. And right now, that happening is at least something like 12 states or something have approved some version of gay marriage.
Right.
And who knows what's going to happen in, you know, another 10 years. I mean, maybe we'll change and we'll be arguing about who gets to have a cow in their backyard.
We are.
We do that all the time.
That's actually a huge movement across the country, you know, as far as people doing DIY gardening and DIY livestock holding. Even here in Oakland, there was a big crisis over whether someone could have some goats in their backyard. Do they need a permit? Would the city give them a permit? Can they just DIY it? Sure, that's already happening.
Yeah. Or even the big cities where there's a lot of argument about whether they should be allowed to have gardens on their roofs.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, having these big arguments with the cities. And unfortunately, sometimes the city's not so happy to let them have gardens when it makes total sense to let them have a freaking garden.
Right.
So it is very interesting, and I'm so fascinated by this. And it's in the novel, and I think partly because I just know so little about these things myself. And I know that having met you and talked with you, that you didn't just like throw some random shit in here. Like, you know a little bit about these things.
Yeah.
And we're putting them together. So when this character shows up and they actually, Don and I think it was Mike, are having this conversation, and he's, you know, here, have my pamphlet. It's a dollar. And they have this argument about, you know, what are you, why are you asking for money? I thought you were a communist. And he goes, you know, the only people who really take this seriously are people who have money. Like, all the communists know how to run this system, the capitalist system, better than the capitalists do.
Mm-hmm.
Which must have come from somewhere, because I'd never heard that before, but I found that so fascinating, that little moment.
Well, there are plenty of fairly wealthy communists. I mean, even Frederick Engels was quite wealthy. He was, you know, inherited a factory concern. And in my experience, back when I was in the ISO in the early 90s, the first people I ever met who had trust funds, which I thought was just like a TV thing previously, were the branch leaders of the ISO. Yeah, so a lot of it was sort of slumming and middle-class guilt and this drive for a rebellious impulse. But also people, you know, really do know how capitalism works. A lot of the folks around the Monthly Review were pretty well off. The radical economist Piero Saffra, you know, became rich because he realized that Japan would retool itself after the Second World War. He bought a lot of Japanese bonds. You know, so there's all sorts of impulses for this sort of thing, actually. And I guess there are two scenes there, right? There are two scenes here. There's one where, you know, someone's revealed to have a lot of money, even though he's a Marxist. And there's a scene where he's trying to sell a pamphlet as opposed to just give you a pamphlet. And certainly, if you've ever done any sort of radical organizing, you always get some wise ass goes, well, why are you charging me for this, you know, newspaper when you believe in giving everything away for free? And the reason is that if you give things away for free, people don't pay attention to them. And that's just a true fact. It's just a weird bit of micro social psychology. So, yeah, you charge 50 cents for your paper or a buck for your paper, and people will kind of look at it more than if you hand it out. And you can see that's the demonstrations. You know, I remember years ago going to a demonstration in D.C., and there was a group called the Workers' World, and they had a free paper, and they would hand out all these papers, and people would just throw it over their shoulders immediately. They'd take it, thanks, and throw it right over their shoulders. So how were they reaching the people, you know, in this way? Who knows? Well, a lot of people who are sort of selling papers, selling a newspaper is a big sort of radical thing to do. You have a little newspaper, and you try to find people who like it and buy it and won't keep coming back. You know, you have to talk to them, and you get a dollar, and you get their name, maybe, invite them to a meeting. That's just how you build an organization. So that's just sort of a real thing that people who have been in these movements would sort of recognize as a true fact.
That's interesting. So that even before, you know, these days where everybody's given everything freaking away for free these days, or even to the extent of they're taking something that was originally valued at $9.99 and now they're selling it for, you know, a dollar.
Yeah.
That there's a recognition within the groups that doing that actually devalues the product because people don't give it the attention it deserves.
Yeah. The only thing that's not like that is this novel itself, actually. Love is the Law was priced at $14.99. Now, I just got my copies today. There's a sticker on it saying $7.99. What happened was is that they got the book, they got the FNGs, the folded and gathered pages, and saw, wow, this book is kind of short. And the trim size is kind of small. And they actually wrote me and said, you know, we can do two things. We can increase the margins and get sort of a thicker, fluffier paper and sell it for $14 or $15 rather, or we can sell it or put a sticker on the cover and make it $8. And I said, well, you know what, just make it $8. Let's try to move some copies for a change. So you can buy this book, Love is the Law, by me, Nick Mamatas, for under $10.
Is that going to be the same price for the ebook?
I guess the ebook price is a function of the paperback price. So I presume, without knowing anything, that it'll be a buck or so less. So let's say the book was $14.99, that might make the ebook $9.99. If this book is $7.99, the ebook might be $5.99. I don't know the price of the ebook yet myself, but I presume it's going to be some fraction of the price of the paperback.
Interesting. So I find that just really kind of
Welcome to publishing. Yeah,
welcome to publishing. We could make the margins bigger and put it on fluffy pages, or we could charge less. Yeah, that's an interesting
kind of. Most writers would choose the fluffy pages. Because royalties, as Stina will tell you, are a fraction of your cover price.
When you see them.
Yeah. I'm not really worried about getting royalties. I'm not waiting for to buy my jet ski and my hang glider with these royalties. I said, I'll just make it $8. It's fine.
Yeah, as Nick knows, one learns not to hold one's breath.
Well, and particularly since you're on a different the other side of it now too, as one who works for a publisher. So
yeah.
Yeah. Well, and you also did in Clark's World and those kinds of things. So it's mm-hmm. not like you've been doing this long enough to know.
That's right.
Yeah. Okay, so we'll pause and I'll just ask my silly question, which is probably just going to be a no, but mm-hmm. I'm going to ask it anyway, which is I discovered there is a song in the 80s that's not a punk song by The Suburbs that has the mm-hmm. same title.
Love Is the Law, yeah.
And was that at all an influence on the title selection?
No, it wasn't. But when I announced the title, when I sold the book and announced the title, people said, oh, have you ever heard the song? And I had not heard it. That's a pretty cool song. But Love Is the Law comes from the Aleister Crowley. It's Love Is the Law, Love Under Will.
Right, right.
Okay. Yeah, right. And the idea is that as a magician, you want to find what your true will is. It's not just doing whatever you want, but doing what you really, really want and are meant to do and are supposed to be doing without the fetters of the social world around you. So you transcend the collective or the herd to find out what your really real individual will was. And that will, he says, will be motivated by love.
Interesting. Yeah. And then that of course has a lot to do with why the character tries to socially condition herself to not say the word justice.
Right.
Yeah. She. I won't ruin it for how she does so, but it crops up a number of times throughout the novel. And actually, she teaches one of the other characters this thing and gets him to do it. I can't remember if he keeps doing it or if it's just the one time. But it is interesting. And when she fails. She has this like moment of just pure anger with herself, and she just has to like really give it to herself, as it were.
Yeah, and that's a national ritual that people do inside the Crowley-esque milieu.
Really?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Things I'm learning
and
from
sometimes,
you.
And sometimes I don't even choose like an important word like justice. That you know, obviously, this woman Dawn is for those reading who haven't read the book, which is everyone who's listening to this podcast. the book is about this woman. Who young woman who's trying to find the killer of her magical/political mentor. So on some level she's seeking justice, but you know that justice does not exist, and that trying to find justice will just distract her from her goal. So she does this ritual to eliminate the word justice from her mind, which means that if you ever think about the word justice, you punish yourself physically. And people do it with all sorts of things, like even like the word the, which is much more challenging than the word justice, as you can imagine, under normal circumstances.
Holy cow.
Yeah, it just to me, it just seems like that there's a whole lot of. She's like her own worst enemy on all sorts of levels, mm-hmm. as far as I see it. She's actually preventing herself from doing many things by limiting her thoughts about justice and this sort of thing. I just find it really interesting the way that the character is. Toying with this idea of control versus chaos and how much control she actually has versus not having versus is she insane? Is she not insane? Or I loved all of that. That was really cool.
Mm-hmm. And that's like a big thing in both the cult circles and radical circles.
Sure.
During the Occupy movement, you could easily find many old leftists saying, well, these kids, they don't know what they're doing. They don't have any good ideas. And of course, they had all the perfect ideas, but they had no access to any person who would listen to them.
Yeah.
Right.
So it's pretty amazing that you have this huge worldwide movement, spontaneously organizing more or less, spontaneously creating all these different ways of communicating within, you know, occupying camps and within, across the occupying camps and across countries and organizing themselves. But they had no ideas. And the people with the perfect ideas who spent years and years working on their ideas and cultivating their ideas and trying to figure out how capitalism works and what to do about it and that sort of thing, had all these wonderful, really well thought out ideas and all these leaflets and all these pamphlets and all these newspapers, but they would have a circle of 10 people.
Mm-hmm.
And the big ones would have like 1,000 people or maybe 800 people would be, you know, in there. And there are probably more people who subscribe to Iguana Monthly than subscribe to Socialist Worker, you know. So if you're so smart, how come you ain't popular? And the same with Equal. If you're so powerful, how come you're just another dipshit on your futon playing video games all day?
Yeah. Yeah.
It's really interesting, too.
I was bothering you a couple of world fantasies ago. Remember that weirdo, Stina, who was bothering you?
Oh, yeah.
He's like, powerful mage. You're that powerful? How come you smell funny?
Yeah. Yeah.
You're so powerful, you know?
That wasn't world fantasy. That was actually world horror.
World horror. Yeah, yeah. Oh, it was Austin? It wasn't San Jose?
It was in Austin. No, you're right. It was World Fantasy Con.
Because in Austin, I was on the committee. I would have drummed in. There would have been a hymn-shaped hole through the glass window if that was in Austin. Because I had the power there. I was on the committee.
That guy. I remember. Screw that guy. Yeah.
Stina will have to tell me this story at some point. Because I don't think she told me.
He was the World Fantasy Creeper in San Diego. He actually walked up and fondled my chest.
Yeah. Not only was he sort of horrible in a sexist way, he just had these delusions of having magical powers.
Yeah. And so anybody who would say anything against whatever it was he was doing was part of some horrible fit-in satanic ramble about how he had all of this power and he was going to destroy us all and with his mind. And, yeah, we would blink and go away in a nanosecond and all this other crap. Yeah. That guy.
Well, okie dokie then. Goodness. Wow.
So there's your average occultist.
There's my average occultist.
I mean, there's plenty of many intellectual occultists and smart occultists as well, but you know, in the milieu of, and this guy was like a metalhead too. You can tell from his haircut and his wardrobe. Not these sort of late teens, early 20s. Sometimes people in the 30s, you know, have these weird ideas about their place in the world and how much power they have. Are interesting to read about. Especially when you put them in a situation where they really do have to do something. And there really is something going on.
Right.
As Don finds out.
Yeah, in the case of Don, right? Weird shit is going on and it gets more and more complicated and effed up as things go along.
But those are things that I really like to read about and play with myself. And I enjoy that. Actually,
and not meet at a party at World Fantasy.
No, definitely don't want to meet that at a party.
Reading a novel is safer.
It's a good enough distance.
Yeah.
When it reaches out and fondles your chest, it's a whole other. Yeah.
Yeah, there's a lot of that going in this genre, science fiction-y community. Okay, cool. So by this time this particular interview goes up, the book will already be out, I think.
Mm-hmm.
But that's okay. That means when people see this, and we'll have mentioned this like a million times because I'm probably going to write a review in the next week.
Well, you know, I've got a question.
Okay.
Did you finish the book,
Sean? I did.
Very good.
Yeah, I got to the part where she goes to prison and that's the last big bits. I'm going to cut this part out because I don't want anybody to hear that part. Because that would ruin the ending.
Yeah, it's not going to ruin the end.
You don't think so?
No.
Okay, I'll leave it in then.
Spoiler!
I don't want to spoil it.
I really am.
Also, no, my first interview with Sean involved him not having finished reading the book.
It was a discussion.
And I'm sorry, and I was a little annoyed because with my last book, Bullet Time, I was sent on a sort of a little book blogger tour answering questions from book bloggers, and none of them had read the book. I don't even know what the book was about or anything like that. So they asked me things like, oh, what was the hottest scene in the book?
Wait, they didn't even try to read it.
No, they didn't even try to read it.
No.
I basically got the questions marked vampire boyfriend, werewolf boyfriend book. You know, and I was told to fill those out.
Oh, my God. Kill, kill, kill. Die, die, die.
Exactly.
So, what can people expect from you in sort of the relatively near future, say post-October, in terms of new work and that thing?
My zombie novel's coming out.
Okay.
Supposedly at the end of this year.
Excellent.
That's 2013. It's called The Last Weekend. It's kind of like a Bukowski meets the zombies novel, I guess you'd say. And I wrote this years and years ago, but it took years to get for the book to find a publisher. Because there are too many zombie novels, as it turns out. Although they keep publishing them, you know. So it'll be coming out from PS Publishing, which is a UK-only imprint. This will be hardcover only, no ebook. And then, if they all sell out, or if I could find somebody in the US to do it, once the book is out, and it gets good reviews, there'll be other formats. Later next year, I've got my first comic book coming out. It's the graphic novel adaptation of the novel All You Need Is Kill by Hiroshi Sakurazaka. Who's one of my J-Dob, this is a day job project I did, and I just wrote the adaption myself for a variety of reasons. mostly having to do with how hard it is to please all the masters that you have to please, because this book is also being adapted into a film, Edge of Tomorrow with Tom Cruise, that'll be out in June.
Oh, wow.
So I had to please my employers, the Japanese author, and Warner Brothers. Even though this comic book is not based at all on the film. It is based on the novel only.
Jeez.
And that was my problem. I had to make sure it wasn't anything like the movie. But I was not allowed to see the movie.
That's right. I remember you telling me this. You're not allowed to see the movie or see anything to do with the movie. But it can't be anything like
it. There. I was told little things. You know, I was shown a little bit of footage. Heard some stuff about the story, you know, that kind of things. Look at a few storyboards.
Holy crap!
I was told, imagine what the movie's going to be like, and then don't do that.
Just like, wow, that's special.
So that's coming out, and that'll be out in May? Late April? Early May?
Okay.
So check that out. Lee Ferguson, a great artist, is our artist.
Excellent, excellent. And then, of course, the film adaptation will come out presumably the month after.
Yep, comes out in June.
Yeah.
And it's Tom Cruise and Emily Blunt, who I like.
Oh.
Excellent. Well, that'd be very interesting.
Big love.
Yeah.
I love Emily Blunt.
Yeah, she's great.
Yeah, we'll get to watch 2 hours.
He's a strong female character.
Ooh.
Yeah.
Awesome.
Yeah. And we'll get to watch him wearing his platform shoes for 2 hours.
Oh, I'm pretty sure they put Emily Blunt in a ditch. Only for the kisses.
Fair enough. Okay, so excellent. So hopefully at the end of the year we'll have the Last Weekend, your zombie novel, which I'm looking forward to, and it is out from PS Publishing, which is really good. They, if I recall correctly, published Osama by Lavi Tidar, which I thought was exceptional.
Yes, that was good.
Yeah. So.
And then it was republished by Solaris, and I hope my book is republished by somebody too.
I hope so.
Solaris.
I cross my fingers for you.
Thanks.
Yeah,
I will totally read your zombie book.
That's right. And if not, I'll take my ebook by myself and make $1 million in school publishing industry. Yeah.
Excellent. Well, so thank you, Nick, for talking to me again. Since this is the second time we've talked. And obviously for letting us see the book. And also thank you for an awesome book, because I really enjoyed it. So, which is probably a good thing.
Yes. Yeah.
And thanks for talking to us and answering questions and shoving some of them back at me.
No problem. Thank you very much. Thank you, Stina. I hope this podcast takes off. I want to see you guys on the Hugo ballot next year.
Well, you could always vote for us.
Can I vote 12 times? That's what I really think I got to do. It seems like what I got to do.
I don't know. Can I
shoplift books and vote 12 times?
Maybe. Well, who knows? Maybe we'll be on the ballot next year.
Now that Steen is on the show, I think you have a chance.
If you would like to send us hate mail on this episode or any other topics we've covered, you can do so in a number of ways. You can send us an email.
SkiffyandFanty@gmail.com.
You can send us a tweet.
@SkiffyandFanty.
Leave a comment on the blog.
SkiffyandFanty.com.
Go to Google+.
Shawnee Jen.
And or Facebook.
The Skiffy and Fanty Show. Our intro music comes from Time Flux by Revolution Void. You can check them out at freemusicarchive.org.
You're just another weak human afraid to face death.
I fart in your general direction!
France, different planet.
The Force will be with you. Always.
End of line.